moving death from death and photography. Interesting way to start the year. But
yeah, I just keep... just want to get it out of the way.
But I keep coming back to Kieran's sentence in the media release, the pressure of being alive. Mm. And I tend to think that both of these shows are more about that than they are about death. In that there's some sort of, and maybe this is pushing it a bit, but there's like a sort of palpable viscosity in the space. You know, it feels sort of physiological, like what it is to be, you know, the heaviness of just being alive. And also the lightness. So it's really sort of, they're both, I get it, sort of both an interest in existentialism through both shows. But I wonder if you could maybe, you could start off, Kieran, on just talking about that sentence and what, how you see that in relation to sort of the larger picture, the theme of the title, death, etc.
Yes.
well, it's a very provocative statement.
Yeah, I think
I'm not seeing death as a bookend. And really, what concerns people about death is the idea of death, and anticipation of death that dominates our living and our actual dead part of our existence. Mm. And so that's the way I was using death. It's more of an idea of death as a pressure of living. Mm. Yeah, if that makes sense. Yeah,
the, well, you know, maybe that sense of anticipation, that sense of yearning, all those things. What about you, Gavin, and me, in that sentence, the pressure of being alive? I'm wondering how... maybe that sentence is somehow sort of pertinent to your installation as
well. Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, one aspect of my work and, you know, how it manifests itself is... that manifesting itself it is important, you know. I mean, it's to do with what, you know, kind of like the human tendency to, what you might do to in the face of the inevitability of death, you know, and time, this idea of studying structures and images and texts and intertextuality as a way of kind of keeping death at arm's length almost comes into it, but it tries to undermine that at the same time. So kind of look at the idea of the monument as, you know, something beautifully futile in terms of existence, you know, but something that seems to be quite necessary at the same time. So in a sense, all the works are timepieces in a way. They're monuments to futility. Looking at the positive aspects of death and annihilation as being the nadir of death.
It's interesting, I think, the timepieces part is really important as well, because that link between life and death is also with time, and that, you know, by each little moment of time, and I think particularly in the video, that video for me is so much about drawn out moment of, and particularly what she's making a finger at, which is like that extended moment of slowly causing your death. But time for me is like that really little death of everything.
Yeah, I mean, it's Joe Sakuna's viscosity. She was bringing it up last week, and it just stuck with me because it seems to suggest a sort of a thickness, like things have been, time has been expanded and pulled out, and in both the works, that sort of leads you in some type of limbo, particularly when you look out the window and you re-engage with the real, with real time. And it's interesting the way you've treated the window surface too, so even that is slightly mediated, that you're looking at real time, at the same time you're caught in that sort of oily surface and that reflection that throws you back into something that maybe back to the screen again. But yeah, time is something that is really is expanded.
That death and time, you know, that's a big part of photography. That holding on and extending, you know, it's the monumental thing in a much different fashion, but, you know, recording of a moment and trying to extend that beyond one moment by recording multiples of it. But then trying to extend the moment beyond the actual moment, it just starts to spiral. But yeah, it's sort of that yeah, time, or sort of extending of that pressure of time, extending the experience of the lived moment beyond what it actually is. So you can always revisit that moment and try and revisit or re-experience it again through photography, which is part of what was going on behind.
And I think in that piece as well, I feel that idea of recreating a moment in like the elements of a moment as well. Mm-hmm. That sort of, I mean, photography and video obviously recreate visually and orally. But with this work, for me, it's like belonging. Well, I kind of thought about, actually, it made me think of someone in a hospital, like someone really prolonging their life as long as possible, but you sort of at the same time reminding them that they're dying. Mm-hmm. And I originally thought, oh, that's a heat lamp. I mean, sorry, I thought it was a glowing lamp.
Yes,
well. And
just,
then,
yeah.
And then as I thought about it, it's actually a heat lamp, so it's kind of this false.
It's a death lamp.
It's killing the thing, yeah. So it's that false reminder of, well, maybe, you know, this is what it was like, but you're actually going to die.
Well, all the forms have got that sort of, the revived analogues with digital feeds.
Yeah.
And yeah. TV, the choice of the TV, the revealing of the tuning device, you know, the fluoro, which is almost gone. Mm. You know, the green fluoro replaced this fluoro, then flavours fluoros you can't get. Yeah. You know, the ubiquitous objects is gone. The linear design speak, which I have at home, the same thing. First thing I did when I came in the other day, I pulled off the screen and checked to see that the cone is starting to dissolve. It's actually disintegrating.
Yeah.
And it's that really assisting that sound, you know?
And they're talking about film as well, and the fact that you're talking about film and that sort of, for me, made me think a lot about, you know, buying enough film, and that was kind of this redundant, almost redundant technology, but that was very much influenced your experience.
The fan being disposed of readily.
And it's all emphasised, I think, too, obviously by the sort of metronome type beat, but also by the cadence of your voice coming through that rather tinny speaker. There seems to be sort of an odd, unexpected relationship between those two, which of course wasn't composed prior.
Because I wasn't at the opening, I wanted to ask about the volume that you chose for the video. No, I just wanted to ask you.
That's an interesting question.
What happened at the opening? For
the volume that you chose for the video to play at, like because of...
At the opening?
Yeah.
That was kind of mediated by the fact that it was going to be volume of people, but then it only could extend so far because the technology didn't allow for any more clarity. No matter how loud it went, it didn't become any clearer. So it was just a decision.
Because a lot of people said they found that frustrating because they said they couldn't. I had someone say to me, they couldn't hear it, and that was kind of like one of the best things about me was. So I think a few people, they're just kind of, I was here at near the start, and there was not so many people, and when I was there, everyone was in there looking, and I was hanging out in this space, and so everyone was listening quite intently, and
And then it got noise loud.
Yeah, well, I guess, when more people arrived, and so, yeah.
It's kind of like a portrait in that respect. Like you paint a portrait, it's a video portrait, and then all of a sudden the sitter's out here. Mm. I don't ask questions.
It is a bit, because it has been strange, because at the opening I had two people come up to me who I didn't know, and they said, oh, hi, and they're like, oh, so is this your whole show? Like, they put the whole thing into me, and I'm like, oh, no, I'm a friend in the earth, it's not, none of it is my work. But I've heard, a few feedback, I've heard it just aesthetically and thematically that there's this continuity between those spaces, and of it belonging to...
I don't think we should apologise in this discussion that we're deliberately blurring the conversation between the two works, which sometimes we demarcate a lot more than this.
Well, that's kind of good curation, but did you know, it was just like fortuitous.
I can take the credit for accosting Kieron in a Vietnamese restaurant, but I didn't know what Kieron was going to do. Mm. I just knew that Kieron would do what Kieron does, but I didn't know what that was going to be specifically.
And did you name the two works separately, or once you...
No. I only noticed, I'm doing a complete double take, when I did see the... it was only when the flyer came in, the invite came in, that I saw...
Oh, not another bloody ritual curator. How tiresome is this, Gavin?
That's why Kieron made the joke, get it out of the way.
That would work in his favour. That would, alright, I'm going to see how this is stuffed up. Death is the best content. And that actually would bring people to see that, to see how you work that one out. Is that sort of an ultimate content?
I think it's a kind of, as a topic, death, I think it's quite broad. I mean, it's quite hard to kind of get wrong in a way.
Go wrong.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it wasn't a conscious decision to come on the back of some rather well-known curated shows last year that featured that theme, and let's face it, the whole of modernism
is
permeated by that theme.
Yeah.
It's as much to do with the completely different practices and responses to what has come to a common point at the outcome rather than at the myth. And maybe this is a good point to go start throwing back towards the individual shows a bit more. You know, one of the things that strikes me about reading the text of companies and shows your use of the word sculptural assemblage. And, I get this sense with assemblage that we're always talking about accretion, we're always talking about adding things. Yet you've created this sort of series of habitats, I like to say, with these sort of glaring omissions between them. These, words have been cut out of sentences, which suggests more decollage to me, which is, it's almost like a removal, if not a physical one, then at least it opens a space for the viewer to actually interact and participate. I'm just sort of wondering how your practice, you told me that it's quite slow in terms of sort of making, groups of works that become ultimately one work. But how does it relate to adding and subtracting in terms of how you work?
I think it kind of comes down to kind of a, I won't say visual, a plastic economy in terms of all the different elements, and not repeating. None of the work's going to... That's awesome now that I think about it. And, there is a lot of repetition in the, in the work in terms of structures, the structure of the pyramid, the video repeating itself, the kind of the
oscillation.
Yeah, the oscillation of the fan.
But there's distinct habitats, I think, though.
I think kind of that formally that comes from film, for me. That's how I see it in terms of how the elements of a film are broken down.
Mm.
So in terms of like the the story, the narrative, the subtext, the art direction, the direction, the dialogue, the actors within it, the sound is broken up, there's a soundtrack, there's dialogue, there's, you know, diegetic sound, but then almost to draw attention, to split them up and draw attention to the text and what is actually going on in the film. So, I kind of analyze the whole visual work in that way, really. And it's just naturally inherent within my work and how I appropriate different materials to different works. But it's an order for me. It's a way of initiating a sensation and a mood and a feeling from each of the works for each of them to do something else and kind of to set up this oscillation of ideas that kind of changes subtly, I think, from piece to piece.
This using that film analogy, is you're talking more about dissolves, this idea of walking and then that one influences this one. There's this lovely jump cuts, and that's what you were sort of talking about, this sort of compartment to the wise.
Sure.
So when the reflection's really at its peak, there's that structural jump to that one, and it hurdles the video hurdles the, you know, jumps back over the pyramid, so to speak, into this image here on the left. So I know it's both, the answer is both.
Yeah.
You are talking more about this sort of dissolve through space, where you walk through the space and these elements are...
Yeah.
If you're here, then it's all about this red light and the beer and how that's
making
it.
It's almost like a conversation kind of. And I felt like that as well, that it was like a language, a very clear language of objects that was saying kind of similar things, even words or discussions, which I guess is like environments within the language.
I think it's as well, it might be a way of visually and sculpturally and orally representing intertextuality as a natural structure of that. I mean, I think that is... I mean, I might think that the essence of my work is really different every time I talk about it, but I think possibly intertextuality could be the essence of my work in terms of... In terms of this dialogue, but that... And intertextuality is a monument as well, you know? I mean, like, intertextuality is like a dialogue between history. It's like being immortal, you know? It's like, being able to include the thoughts of, first century, philosopher in your work, and almost kind of thread that through, but almost that journey, personal journey, in terms of finding those connections throughout, texts and books, and then bringing them, through with your own work. I find that really comforting, and that's a sort of kind of movement that. Props up my
and there's
work,
that other thing where they have conversations with your own previous history of work, more so perhaps, where this piece would talk about a piece that you might have done 10 years ago or something, that you trace back that way. That's a strange parallel, that one.
I really like
you ditch the history for a bit.
Stuff we're talking about, the monuments, the other day we were talking about the enigmatic monument and how, this obviously is a monument of sorts that we understand readily, but then the way that the two photographs talk about the idea of monument, like a creative and fictitious monument from his from his memory as a child, and then something that snapped kind of simply as a Polaroid. But that flexibility of the idea of the monument that can be kind of sometimes almost pathetic and sometimes quite grandiose is really interesting, and which comes across in the work quite strongly as well. Just and it could, if you feel like it could go even further, like what else can a monument become, or how long does it have to be around to actually be a monument? Can it be for a couple of seconds and then like a short monument? Or for millions of years, you know?
Yeah. And you know, I think Hal Foster refers to it as, you know, mining the vertical axis of history, and you know, and it's quite sort of refreshing to see that being such a it's almost like a renaissance after we've been through this sort of horizontal slide through the surface of popular culture.
Sure,
yeah. It's really you could have easily just tapped into like a 1970s non-human type of, you know, refusion type of genre piece.
Sure, yeah.
But you haven't. It comes from Guatemala Clark, but So, you know, and you haven't done that. I mean, it just sort of somehow floats across, you know, centuries of I guess references.
Yeah, I mean, I would consider myself an incrementalist in terms of this kind of layering of the previous, you know, and what has been gathering and what you know. I mean, there is an element of, I guess, everything that came before, you know. There is an element of post production, cultural, visual and kind of textual reappropriation, but it's quite personal. You know, I'm not very much interested in taking cultural products verbatim, you know, and representing them.
Sure.
So, so in that sense, I think it's quite different from certain recent movements.
One of the post-production qualities I like most in the show is this, the render window being so large. You know, when you render a film, this is about the speed that you never see that. And I really enjoy watching a film when it's rendering, you know. And the relationship it has to the small image over here, like this is really about the biggest window I look at on the laptop when I render a film.
Mm.
And to see the big render, and the pulse is the right speed for that, and it can't quite determine the speed of the slowest motion. So it feels like the, and then when the buzz cuts through, it's that you're ready to burn or fuse or whatever you do.
Yeah, it's done.
But it's such a clean and big, you know, render image. It's just, I don't know, I've seen someone really talk about the render window, you know. You may not be deliberating to do it or not, but it just does it for me, you know. It's just like, I'm looking over, thinking how much longer it got until it's going to be rendering. You know? This is a slight posterizing over the video, whatever you've done, this little, this slight pump in the colour that's just broken the form up a little more, plus the, plus the film itself when you shot it and the soft focus. But this just is pump up the colour. I just see this, you know. I loved it when I saw it the first time when you submitted the work. That's, you know, and it's a reminder of them, but it's just so much better at the slow scale.
Yeah.
On that bubble screen, the two bubble screens are great too. We're not obviously talking about the screen there, but just when we do. It's just great, really great conversation between these two monitors, you know.
And I really love the story behind the Paramount picture. It's just so beautiful. Like, I didn't realise that the first time I saw it, and I just saw it as a mountain, like a kind of utopian mountain.
Is it something that should be spoken about, because given that maybe that things get read?
Well, I think it's really interesting.
Maybe you should talk about its positioning in the space, and then maybe to the story behind it, and why you chose to put it all outside of the the grouping of words, whether it was a preface to the whole show or whether you see it as part of one specific work, and then make the story behind it.
I don't know how conscious it was. I mean, in terms of actually prefacing the show with that piece, and because I have shown certain of these works in various, not in this in this setup, but in kind of various configurations, and it is part of a slightly larger series of works made over a period of a year, thought about for a year or more before that. So they have been configured differently for. So when I have shown the works before, different pieces have come before that piece. In fact, when I showed the work before, that was almost the next to last piece that you came to. It just kind of felt right within this space that piece should introduce the works. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it is it does come from a title screen of a film. So, it could be read as an introduction and also an introduction. I'm trying to make up a word. It's also a unprologue in terms of the fact that it's not that anymore. Maybe it's I've prefaced the work with different pieces before. Once I prefaced the work with a piece called "Once Again You Will Be Born from a Belly," which was a stop sign that turned green, and had had these two frequencies pulsing in and out, and it basically I put it at the beginning of that show. Preface the idea of it was a dialectic network. And just to set up a philosophical standpoint, a question standpoint at the beginning of the exhibition. And I kind of feel like this configuration of works is a lot less text based than how I've shown this series previously. So I think prefacing the work with the show with that is quite apt now that I think about it, because this work is, once you kind of go into the background to it, it's about loss and forgetting and information dissolving and images and monuments becoming enigmatic over time. And so it's about the extraction of information from becoming, and the movement towards death and entropy. That's what that is about. It's about the extraction. It's about obviously getting to a certain point of accumulation, and then it's about extraction of energy, information, you know,
idea of extraction, extraction versus assemblage, I think is really key to...
And then it was created from a memory in the first place, like something was built and added to an attitude, and then taken away, and then maybe disappear.
It doesn't simply rest in a sort of utopic, dystopic... duality, which is how quite a few people have read it actually.
Right.
which I guess is more of an obvious take on it. And the other obvious take is that it's bound somehow to this work.
If you wanted
that, I'd imagine you would have positioned it in the room with this work.
Yeah, I mean, I was quite happy with that. I mean, they weren't consciously made because it, you know, had a similar shape, but I liked that they did when it was coming.
It's nice with the other, the bookend is that impression that this cast is.
Yeah.
So that stretches out and it leapfrogs in a way. It goes on the thing behind the glass to the thing behind the glass. Certainly that my last visit, that was the sort of feeling we had about sort of the way that they works jumping around. As opposed to who's old, but it's time of day, reader, and all that stuff.
Which you know, maybe Kieron, we could talk too about what's been taken out of that space in terms of the installation. But I always find these moments really interesting. These decisions somehow speak volumes about how we subsequently read the work, whether we know it or not, what the artist is taking out.
A lot was taken out of the space. And I think that was, as you were here during the week, and as I brought more stuff in at the start, there was some panic. But it was a process of, I think, and preface the story, when you originally was asked about this show, I got the space wrong in my head. I had a plan that when I realised that I was dealing with a different ceiling than this open ceiling, radical change that I thought I could be doing. And the video was always in the show, just how it was being worked out. And then dealing with the smaller space here, it became much less. I couldn't resolve it in my head. I actually had to come in and resolve it in the space itself. And what I think earlier on we were talking about, what I was like about that space is pressure of that space, which kind of works with what I was writing about, that pressure of living with that. The enclosure space is actually quite close, and with the gaps that are at the top and nothing's quite flush. You get a sense of outsideness, but you get a sense that you're not in part of it. It's like a wall you can't see over the top. You're aware that there's something beyond it, but you're very much feeling inside. And that I wanted to keep that in. Initially, I had all these other elements, which I spent some of them I spent a while putting together because I thought this would work and how to reference that outside and how to highlight that, and then bring it into the space. And it was funny watching Gavin work as well at the same time. Stuff just kept disappearing. A little bit I did in a week, and what I brought in just disappeared until the 3 o'clock before the show opened.
What did you have?
Kind of six, the last piece disappeared.
It's helpful to me because it shows not to have it.
You can't say that,
then
explain what it was.
There was various things. There was something that the monitor originally was thinking of sitting it on, and then there was some sort of sculptural type objects, and then there was some photographs at some point, but as they kind of disappeared and the others would appear, it was basically sorting through a lot of ideas in my head to visualise them and realise that this is messing this up, it's obscuring the vision rather than clarifying anything. And in the end, what we end up with is kind of, I thought, triggered the space and played up the space well.
Because that's what I was going to say, when Gavin was talking about, because I found it difficult to be, in this exhibition when there's other people around, so I've actually found it difficult to give your work, and I haven't, sat through Kieron's piece. But I was thinking that, your space feels, my terminology, like a haptic, like, is that kind of like uncomfortable, so it feels very, so there's something in these of being here, and I was thinking that it's so you just kind of, like that sense of walking around from one object to another, but also being distracted by, because it kind of feels like really visually, aesthetically really pleasing to the eye when you first come in. It's like, oh wow, and then sort of and then even in the review in the paper, I saw it and was like, oh, what's that? Like, it's really striking aesthetically, the work. It was your show, and but I was thinking, but the contrast is with the way Kieron's it's so pared back. Like, there's nothing apart from the monitor and my face and my words, really. I mean, maybe you can look at the walls, but I think
pretty amazing, yeah.
And the ceiling, and yeah. So I just sort of think about that kind of contrast between, just sort of that intensity of attention to one object versus like that kind of flitting around from one thing to another. And so I was just wondering whether, like, you know, with that deaf thing, because I have that a bit, because with my work, I work across different new materials, that I have this sense that I want people to feel comfortable, even though, like, I'm dealing with stuff to do with anxiety, or, there's this sense that I want people to feel like they understand, the objects and these kind of formal aesthetic qualities, to make them feel at ease. When it's a subject that may make people feel a bit uncomfortable. So
I thought, because people, at the opening were saying to me that I was very brave, you know, to be in that,
you're very brave, and then, I would never have done that. But I actually think, Curon, because it's not hiding behind. And then there's also that sense, in terms of your ego, because people have said, it's like that it's my work, or even I think it's my work, and where are you in it? And so I think it's about like ego, like it's sort of slightly ego.
But there's something really pared back about it. There's something extremely maximal about the whole experience. And there's, you're in there, and it's like the way your brain's in this space, it's literally like she's been completely restrained by these. Television set, and then the television set in turn has been completely restrained by the enclosure space.
Yeah.
And there's something relentless about it. It reminds me of Gus Van Sant's Jerry or something. Basically, you're strapped into the journey. That's it. Mm. Where do you stand? Do you sit? Do you engage with it? Okay, so you get down on the floor and you run your fingers along the surface of the floorboards whilst you're looking at the pores and the skin. Mm. It's a really take it or leave it experience.
Yeah.
And I haven't experienced that sort of fuck off quality in your way before. I was quite sort of taken with the rawness of it, the rawness of the installation in relation to the rawness of the shoot, and the way that the camera, is trained on the face. It's really aligned with the installation as a whole.
Yeah. I don't know. I just found that, like, the framing, and it really is this frankness in Sammy's delivery of what she's talking about, and this frankness in the story, which is why I wanted to work with Sammy too. She has an openness and frankness to the way she talks anyway. But, it's obviously, I'll call it enjoy. And it was sort of to obscure it or hide it or try and pretend that it's not there by dressing up the setup with making it more comfortable, more accessible with the installation. It didn't work for me. It made it more confusing and didn't give people a position of where I was standing in it. And that was where I was standing, was that, well, here it is, this is it, and if you're going to engage in it, you're going to engage in it. You have to choose to go into it and go into the whole way, or just don't choose to be involved in it and just have that uncomfortable feeling of turning away or being turned away if you can't deal with that. Yeah, and that's why we shot it as well, and with that sort of idea in mind, getting up. Sandy didn't know that.
Yeah, so I thought.
You didn't know how close?
No, because I was in the studio and I was like, I thought it was this heroic, frame of me in my studio. with this stuff. And then Karen said, I shot close afterwards, so it's like I wanted to see it, and the looking up the nose,
I couldn't see any snot, so...
But the warmth comes in your reflection of your glasses.
Yeah.
So you see your studio through your glasses,
yeah.
Which is really, really...
And there is a point where outside is reflected in through the glasses. Yeah. Well, isn't there? Through a window or something like that.
Yeah. I remember seeing that there was... Because there was definitely this tension built up. And then there is this sudden... certain kind of release where you can actually see the outside world, you know? Yeah. I'm not sure what point in the actual text, and it's such an intense kind of film situation as well, the way it's framed and the way the story is related.
I didn't get any of that. I was just so in the story. Like, imagining your grandma's house and imagining you with Joe, and like, I really didn't. I mean, it took the second loop for me to notice even the framing and stuff. I was really just thinking. You know what I mean? I didn't notice the reflection
of the glasses
because I was imagining.
That's quite interesting because of the that flash show, the positioning of the work in the court, and the both you were involved in it, that there was I just, you know, get going back to that. But it's actually when I was listening to you, I was actually seeing that work.
Oh, good.
And, and maybe it was the positioning of this work here at the front, you know. I just have, you know, if I see a lot of the shows, I just build up the memory of. And witness positioning of work.
Yeah.
The positioning of the video on the monitor is really quite important. You know, just it's a space that hasn't been used, you know, it's either wall or it's into the corner. This one is pushed out beyond the perimeter, you know, so that you have to do exactly what you've been saying. You have to commit to it. But at the same time, you're constantly looking down for the majority, and that sets up that polemic between the reader and the work. That is a majority of people will not lie down and watch the view at the same, camera angle. You know, it sets up. You know, you set up a you set up an emotional framework. Because of the way that the person has to view the video, that's clever. You know, that's just clever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's, you know, really, you know, smart, sharp.
But also, I was really impressed with the... Because, with the filming and the way he framed... Because it just felt like it was very, like, haphazard. The way that occurred. You know, like, I'd be in my studio and, I mean, Kieran, I don't exactly know why... you wanted to do this thing, you know, like with the deck and me, like in, I mean, apart from just saying it, why are you being wanting to make it work?
It's something like
that. So that you tried and you feel good.
It's a thing that comes in my work anyway, I was trying to get to, and then in thinking about it. This story originally when you told it to me, it stuck with me since, and that was in relation to another show we're putting together. And just that it stuck with me in, you know, in relation to my own practice and other things I like to work with. But this is actually really succinct what you're doing, the way you told that story, because of the parallels of the stories within the story, with your grandmother, then the relationship to photography and art making that runs parallel to this drive for or against or away from confronting the idea of death and that pressure of living, which I thought works with what I like to think about anyway.
Because it was interesting, because we had some people, like, I think you were saying that, said, they thought they'd seen it before.
Someone told me they'd seen the video before, they were reflecting.
Because I made a work about my experience with all the photos, with pictures of Joe, and my grandmother. But yeah, but I was
about what you were talking about.
So all that stuff. Yeah, so in our discussions, which continued from our doubt show when we had the poll show at BCA in one of those meetings. Yeah, I was talking about what I wanted to do, and. But it's interesting, for me, because I've got, you know, the pictures that kind of distract, you know, people, and kind of slightly entertain them, because, you know, I've got this, images of Europe and my grandmother's house, and I've got some jokes in there as well, so it's like, you know, for Kieran just to, you know, pare it down to its kind of, like, this is all... So instead of talking about, it'd be interesting maybe to show them together, like my story.
And you think about it like that as the narration to the work. But to make a work of the narration of someone else's work.
That's what I was trying to get to with that positioning of the monitor allows the narration to occur.
Yeah.
And you're halfway there then. You know, then people can spend the time through the work. It's too easy to dismiss, you know. Not that, you know.
And maybe if the photographs were there, I wonder if people would just be more comfortable if they were just looking at the photographs as we're talking.
Yeah.
And maybe not. Because you were saying a lot of people were really uncomfortable sticking it out or looking.
Have you found that? Like, people don't
The real inside out to me is not the entrapment of the image within the television, it's more whether people know the subject or not.
Yeah, do you think that is?
Given
that
you're
a
sort of a local artist, should we say a public persona or a semi-public persona? You know what I'm trying to say? Some people know who you are. Other people you defer talking to him.
Yeah.
Yet a very closely confident.
Well, that's it. It's hard when you're learning subjectively.
And I think that really reflects how you read the work.
Or how long you read the work for, is that what
you're saying? And I think we were talking earlier about how Simon Austin commented at the opening, how he was catching fragments of what you were saying. He heard some tag come through the air, or point and shoot, and then maybe a glimmer of reflection on your glasses or a flash of some of your teeth, and thought that was a perfectly valid way to read the work.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas other people would felt this anxiety to hear the story from beginning to end. And I guess that's where the Jerry analogy comes in, that you take your Kenny Dickens and out of this thing, or what sort of commitment are you asking me for here? I felt it set up a real sort of inside outside sort of parameter there. And I think spoke volumes about the sort of social art world that we have in Melbourne as well.
Mm-hmm.
One artist sharing the story of another artist, given our audience.
Is that something that you're interested in exploring? Not the subject.
It's part of the work. I don't know. That's my circle. But it was more as a way of working. It's much easier to work with someone who I've got a relationship with, because I'm not very good at directing people to do something that they don't naturally do. It's much easier to work with someone who does something naturally that I'm interested in. So in this case, Sanya has a way of articulating herself which I'm interested in, and also subject matter I was interested in, and all I have to do then is work out how to control the filming side of that and just let Sanya be Sanya.
So do you see Sanya as a material
Yeah.
A little bit, yes.
But in the same way that Sanya's also ostensibly there to visit a grandmother and ends up using...
And that relationship is, I'm also displaying our relationship and that interest. I know Sandy's got, in this context of Melbourne, I know she has a, there is some, not leverage, but, that the fact that other people know her, that also adds another layer to the way people will interact and relate to the work. But I hope that people don't have any idea of who the person in the video is.
It stands alone.
But will still stand alone. And they will pick up our relationship through the way that it's presented.
Which I think it does stand alone. It's a different sort of take on it.
Yeah.
It's no sort of better or worse. It's just a slightly different thing. But it's interesting in relation to you, Gavin, in how, you've had some connection with Melbourne in the past and you're sort of coming back in. And, I guess for us here too, the show containing a lot of prior-made objects and you're sort of composing them in the space is something that we've been moving towards a little more after having a very sort of, more of a site-specific history where, the things are sort of created on the old side.
it's almost sort of like a metaphor of, you know, the international artist being, you know, visiting, revisiting the city, you know, and how do you help take on the experience?
Interesting logistically, I guess. It interests me as well. I mean, to talk about how sluggishly I work. Piece on the plinth. The genesis of that originated in Melbourne about 4 or 5 years ago, where I kind of just wrote down in my notebook that I would make these pieces that related the temporal and flatten it out, you know. And so this piece where a piece of video is taken kind of frame for frame, were originally spatial works. So they were taken frame by frame, flattened out, and printed. Yeah. And
what do you mean by flattened out?
Oh, so if that's like 25 frames per second, and it's 10 seconds, so it's 250 frames over a split into a grid. It was kind of an attempt to make the ephemeral structural, which, as you can kind of see through the current little work, is kind of, it's still important. But that basically morphed into that work back there. So
that's so disappointing. You've deflated my whole fantasy of what's been the most Irish work here. I had all these Eulogian fantasies, same in Finnegan's Wake, you know. Yeah. You know, all the punctuation, we removed the time, everything was just, it was my perfect fantasy.
We can delete that.
Melbourne.
We can delete that bit out. We can delete that bit out.
But, that just kind of came out of being here. So it's kind of apt in a way that it's...
When it came out of being here, did you see that scene, or what happened?
The scene even goes further back to when Ireland was the first European country to ban smoking in the workplace. That basically meant that you couldn't smoke in restaurants, pubs, office buildings. So, we're not as backward as everyone thinks. So there was just this whole thing of people just going out onto the street to smoke, you know, on their own quite often. And it was just one of those ubiquitous things. And there was kind of a something current running in my work where I was taking the idea of the landscape and the subject and splitting them up and kind of composing this, you know, dream of a world without people, you know, and kind of stepping up and actually being able to separate them, you know, maybe living out the Enlightenment dream of, non-participation or something. And so I made a few works with that were kind of subject-centered and landscape-centered, I guess. And so that kind of fit in quite well to that. And then the oddness of, as an ex-smoker then, I remember the thing, the sudden change of seeing people smoke and thinking how alien it looked, you know? and just how artificial it was. It was such a man-made artificial creation, you know. And so that then tied back in again to the idea of the man-made monument and the, you know,
and the level of hostility that's directed towards the ailments and like that too is
and in that work the exhaled smoke almost is like the artificial breath, you know, the human in the, you know, man-made artificial, you know, environment, you know, and this kind of representing this desire to, you know, manipulate the environment.
It's a pressure of life, I suppose, you know, this is a sucker back really quickly.
I realise that's I've gone quite tangential from your question about what it was like to come back to Melbourne and show work.
Yeah,
it's got this.
Yeah, okay, so I've got there's sort of a modus operandi to, you know, like a strategy on that strategy of operandi, which is, I'm not sure of, but I'm sort of gleaning from this show. You have these works that you take, you know, a lot of time to work on singular pieces, and then you sort of congeal parts of them around a certain.
And it goes back to the what I see as the kind of structural beauty of intertextuality, of a kind of a heteroglossia of images and ideas and texts, and you know how and how that kind of creates the work over a very long period of time. And, you know, kind of things that are kind of sticking in memory and, you know, really kind of heavy things and then really trite, seemingly things from trite sources. One of my sources for some of my works is this poem by this Brooklyn poet, Fillmore Schwartz. The reason why I know of Delmore's work is because when I was making the show that preceded this work, which was based more directly on Nietzsche's concept of eternal return, and this bit of text popped into my head, and the text was Time of the Fire in Which We Burn. And I was kind of going, that seems really apt to me right now. And I didn't know why. And then I remembered where I had heard it, which was stranger still, which was from the film Star Trek Generations, where the bad guy, Tolian Saren, says to Picard, time is the fire in which we burn, and... it kind of relates into the story, so I looked into that and found out that actually that was talking exactly about Eternal Return, and Star Trek Generations is partly based on the concept of Eternal Return, and Fillmore Schwartz's poem is relates to Eternal Return, but also related to Milan Kundera was speaking about in the verbal life of being, which was also written at the time, and it was just kind of one of those kind of epiphany moments where, you know, all these disparate and I guess that kind of leads into the idea of participation in the universe and going into the subatomic and how everything is connected. And that moment of us, you know. And,
but it's fascinating how those connections are like sort of floating.
Yeah.
Okay, so what? How do you see the next few months now panning out? You've got an opportunity to keep working in Melbourne. And is that a time now for sort of closing off this work, or would you then take components from this and use that as a continuum as well?
Yeah, I think this was a bit of a project, you know, so I've had kind of interests kind of popping up in the past year that, I guess, as any artist knows, you know, you kind of like work with ideas for such a long time, and then, you know, shows happen years after you propose them, and then you have to stop yourself making the work that you that is fresh in your mind and you've thought about in the meantime, you know, and kind of push that away. So yeah, so there's been a couple of works that, and I think I'm really, showing this work beside, something as just singularly strong as Kieran's work is quite apt. I'm kind of working towards that that idea of
Monterey
says about the eulogy to the blank page, where, you know, the artist must, the purpose of the artist is to educate himself to silence. I think I'm going to be kind of pairing backwards and making more singular words, maybe. I don't know. But it's a good time. Having said that, I'm working on after having kind of gone away from making kind of video work and narrative work, conventionally narrative work maybe, and making that more sculptural, I'm going to try and go back into make a film where maybe kind of taking the exploded aspects of a film and putting it back into a film piece, and the idea of that is about recreating an Art Deco building that was kind of this iconic building on the seashore of Dublin, which was knocked down in some kind of horrible 1970s planning folly. So it was only in existence for about 40 years, something like that, and the IMCO building. So for some reason I'm just obsessed with this building that no one knows anything about.
Don't tell me you're going to do a test of the day, though.
I think it's going to be like a detective story, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's
seen through the eyes of a dead American journalist called Mumford. Anyway, I'll end on that.
So, what year were you born? Were you around when the building was around, or did you ever?
Yeah, no, I wasn't. When I was moving out last, I didn't have very much storage where I was moving to, and there was this old chest in my brother's room that had old VHS tapes in it, and I said to my mother, "I'm having that." And I took all the VHS tapes out, because I'm super clean, I went to cleaning it, and I took out, you know, the way in chests of drawers you lay down bits of paper and stuff at the bottom of them, you know, for some reason. And so I took up the first bit of paper, and it was a newspaper from the early 80s. The second bit of paper was a bit of packaging from the, 40s, 1947, addressed to my grandmother, who lived in Donegal, which is the other side of Ireland. And it had this image of this building on it, the Imco building, who were a dry cleaners when dry cleaning had to be done in huge, purpose-built industrial spaces, you know. Shit, I'm giving away my whole next.
It's alright. I'm sure we
the thought process is really interesting.
But it's, I've never seen this before, and I said to my dad, what's IMCO? And he kind of went, oh, is this a beautiful building on the coast of South County Dublin that was demolished in the 1970s? So mid-1970s, I was born in 1973. So I never knew it. And it's just this...
Did you find it strange, like, that you're interested in something before you were born? You know, like, you want to make it work. You know, like, I mean, you sort of feel passionate about something that existed then.
Okay.
It's kind of that it's been removed.
It's kind of emblematic, though, of something else, you know. And then it's also emblematic of kind of the short-sightedness of kind of a certain kind of, you know, decision. You know, progress for the sake of progress, and which kind of, you know, Mumford has done some interesting ideas on. But it was just such a kind of a beautiful image. I wanted to, you know, about it. So I guess maybe resurrecting that will be an interesting process.
But I think that thought process is interesting because, you know, what we've got here is a very sort of elegant, refined installation where, you know, the word resolved comes to mind.
Mm.
As Penny pointed out, it's a vehicle for, you know, presentation of ideas. But to extrapolate on that, it's a presentation of how ideas don't always connect correctly, or misinformation, the space that, you know, you somehow articulated in your thought processes through this conversation, that all these moments of serendipity, random, orchestrated, somehow they all float around out there.
Yeah.
And so within this vehicle of resolve, I think you've successfully articulated how we have these random thought processes that we seek or sometimes come to us.
Mm.
Those little pockets of experience give you the permission to make it work. When you pull back that drawer and you see that bit of newspaper and you go, oh, hang on, this is the stuff that's actually fucking up my videotapes because it's making little bugs and stuff. But you go, no, that's the bit of newspaper that's going to inform me about my next work. Because then it wouldn't mind your video. Draw a bit of paper. The last thing you do.
Where's you, Karen? Fixate. Examined, scrutinised a certain sort of moment, even though the subject's talking about another moment, it's really quite a different way of approaching.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. But I think this is right to what Gavin's talking about.
Yes.
This makes sense to me. It's genius. Can't beat you to it.
That's great.
Like Gavin's talked about his work in this exhibition and the way he's talking about his work and that drawing out of thinking about something for so long and even, you know, the refine this older material Gavin's using now and re-freeing it out and the monumentalisation of that and then this new work. I find I can write that easily.
But there's a distillation.
Yes.
Somehow it goes on here, whereas in many ways you've chosen to sort of assume that.
But it's also interesting, Gavin was saying he wants to distill more.
Yes.
But I'm in the same time thinking, all right, I'm going to stop for a while, because I really think that I need to expand that out and bring in more elements and allow people to make their own connections more rather than me just say this is it. This is
I think early on when you first started speaking, you were talking about how that point of placing in here, not
quite reading the space the way you remembered it.
Yeah.
It, the space forced you to throw things out for a good while.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you sort of outwitted it.
Yeah.
And end up with that, you know, that the remarks that you did make.
Yeah.
By bringing in all these sort of things that anticipate. You know, because you're thinking about the show, but you're not here. You go to this comfortable space all the time, but you still, when you go put your work in, it's not the same. Somehow this show, the space seems really small with these two work. Other times this space seems massive, and it swallows work up. You know, it seems like this. They're relatively small work, but it seems to make the space really small. And it's an enclosure for this chat, but it's also something to do with the position in the content. It's made the space feel very small compared to other experiences that we have here.
That's true.
Maybe the blacking out, it's the light coming in a bit too. But
I was thinking of when you talked about seeing the reflection of Sandra's glasses in the video, and seeing, you know, I think really early on when Gavin had set up and looking at the reflections in the windows, how that was stopping people escaping out the windows, because with what you've done to the windows, you see the reflections of the pyramid, which is kind of, it pushes you back in, and the only point to escape was through Senya's glasses.
That hurts you.
Through the screen.
Just through the screen, which is really tight.
Yeah.
But that decision to shade the windows and bring it back in, and then what that caused, what Gavin's works, push you back into the work, stop you going out, force you back in all the time. And then the way Gavin's work was set up, which kind of implies that there's room, but there's not. Like, you walk in and you're not, there's no real comfort. We had a conversation about where people would go on the opening, and we picked like two or three areas that they would group, because that's the only possible area that could maybe be comfortable in a group. Otherwise, they're actually inside the work, they're imposing on the work, and they've got to interact, and, you know, it's very difficult to find a resting point.
There's three very serious chord scatters, isn't it?
Yeah.
Demarcate.
But I think both are actually not consciously sort of navigating the view of these shows.
Yeah.
I mean, that gets back to the, you know, sort of viscosity word that I was using. There's a certain sort of atmosphere that's quite sort of thick, and that translates through a sort of a navigation sense where, you know, the objects actually create a certain sort of spatial aura around them that is much greater than their actual physical dimensions, which creates a feeling of sort of comfort and discomfort. And that happens just as much in the enclosure as it does in here.
And I think it happens beyond the experience as well. Mm-hmm. So for me, it happened, like, you know, I spoke to Gavin 2 days after I saw the show, and during those 2 days I think more happened within my head than it did in the space, and same with Kieran. Like, that space kind of expands outside into your thought process as well.
I had a really spooky moment with Meredith Turnbull standing there with her glasses, catching the reflection of this piece, with Ross taking a photo of the reflection. He was showing me his camera while she's got a reflection. It was all just too much. Sort of all the mirrors experience. I think I've been in here for too long.
Yeah, exactly.